Okay, folks, I think everybody has their glasses replenished and they've made their visits to the small rooms and whatever, and so we can get on with the final part of the evening. If I can start with Andy, we hear a lot in the publishing industry about how boys don't read, and we must do stuff to encourage boys to read. Now, clearly you're in that business. What is it that you actually do to encourage boys to read?
I think I try and write as stories that I used to enjoy reading at that age. And I think a lot of it's escapism. I think a lot of it is trying to deal with issues that teenagers face. A lot of it is identity. A lot of it is relationships. To be honest, I still face that now. And I'm certainly not a teenager. But I think it's things that... It's okay, I am a teenager. And I think it's just things that we all can associate with. I think for boys in particular, for reading, it's I'm convinced that there needs to be a little bit of danger, a little bit of thrill is the adventure. And I think it's a lot of it is they see themselves as the main character, or certainly as one of the characters in it.
And in terms of a business, when we see YA books all over the trade papers and whatever, they're always like romances for girls and whatever. So how does writing books for teenage boys actually sell?
It's difficult. I mean, there's a big drive at the moment to try and take sex, not as an activity, but as a gender out of the equation. So it's not books for boys, books for girls. There's a big, big push at the moment to try and make books more appealing to both sexes. And there's a real big push at the moment. In fact, there's almost a negative backwash about books that are exclusively for either boys or girls. I think it's just a push just in general terms. I think it's not just publishing. I think it's the same in the job markets. Everyone wants to be seen as equals, I think. I was at a writing festival a few weeks back, and there was a woman on the panel that writes young adult, and her publishers got the front cover, because she writes romance, a very, very pink cover. And she went to a school to do a talk, and she was trying to get some of the kids there prior to her getting there to read some, so there was a Q&A session. And the feedback she got from a few of those was, "I don't read pink books." So she was actually quite upset that her publishers put a pink cover on, because boys just didn't want to read it. So I think it's not just what the material is, it's how it's presented as well.
Well, you know, women science fiction writers have been saying this for years. You know, they pinkify the covers, and consequently our sales go down through the floor, and the publishers insist, no, they must do this for the books to sell. It's nonsense, and I'm delighted to hear they are finally getting the message. Anyway, moving on to Ken, who I'm glad to see is wearing pink. He's obviously doing his bit for gender equality. You know, the one thing that you should never ask an author is where they get their ideas from. But Benny Hill, why?
Well, Benny Hill that came to head largely as a result of something that unfortunately takes up a very large part of my mind, with results that are sometimes beneficial and sometimes a damn nuisance. Or more accurately, my memory, which is that, like a fair few people, I've been steeped in, well, certainly the best part of 50 years of pop culture, as long as my memories go back. And it takes in everything, whether it's more obvious science fiction, horror, fantasy, but comedy comes into there as well, of all sorts, TV, films, radio. It all goes in there, swirls around, forces out the more useful stuff, but sits there, gloating at you. But every once in a while, someone will come along and say, "Well, I'd like a story that's based around puns and or humour or something like that. What do you think you could do that is a bit different from the usual?" And he goes to the pop culture well, or I do, and try and find something that maybe hasn't been disturbed on the sludge quite that much recently. You try and look past, further beyond the great geological layers of Harry Potter and Star Wars, and you move further down and down and down. And eventually you find the Champions, and you find Benny Hill, and you find, yes, Bill and Ben, for all I know, for all the fact they've had a revival recently. And that's largely how it works. It's dredging up what's there and seeing what fits the story, largely. And pop culture, for better or worse, has led to a large part of what I've written, and you can feel its influence everywhere, whether it's passing mentions or very central to the plot, like here.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to that, because I saw something on Twitter either today or yesterday about with James Garner having just died. Somebody mentioned that the character of Troy Tempest from Stingray was actually modelled on James Garner. And that has somehow led me to writing a story about mermaids. But, yeah, I needed a story anyway, so thank you very much, Troy Tempest. Have you actually tried to sell that story, Ken? And if so, what sort of reaction have you got from people?
Well, to be blunt, I've only tried selling it to one person, that was someone specifically asking for pun-related supernatural horror stories. It was turned down in the final cut. I can't imagine why. Yes, I mean, well, maybe I can, on reflection. But, you know, it's something that, as with all the odd work, and it's the other thing that a lot of people say, keep it anyway. Somewhere, or sooner or later, there's going to be someone who is going to want to buy that for however large or smaller price and publish it, and so it waits its time and it will go out to other people in due course eventually. But at the moment, it's a bit of a back-boiler thing now it's written, and several other stories are on the go for other anthologies, so it waits its time, much like Hill himself.
We need somebody to do a Kickstarter campaign for stories about Benny Hill. We do have in the audience today an expert on demonology. Jonathan, what did you think of the philosophical stuff?
Agree with a great deal of that myself. They're transcultural, so the whole Christian thing doesn't really stick. In fact, I just submitted a story last week, which has a demon in it, and it doesn't really go into any kind of anti-Christian thing about it at all. Admittedly, it's in hell and all the rest of it, but, you know, that's all kind of just peripheral stuff. Well, there's more important things to their existence than that, so yes, I'll go along with that.
Okay, we do also, of course, have somebody write stuff for boys. And Kevin, have you experienced the same pressure from publishers to make things gender-free?
It's definitely something that is a movement at the minute, and I've been involved through my work with Abino as I write Minnie the Minx as a 40-year-old man. When I was growing up and I read the Abino back then, is that Minnie was my strip I read first, and so it was actually quite interesting to hear this. But as I go around schools, and I do work in schools, you quite often get this thing saying, oh, I won't read that, it's too with girls, isn't it? So slightly higher than that, usually. It is a major thing at the moment, and what we've seen is publishers who publish things like stories for girls, stories for boys, have now come out and said, no, we're not doing that. Osborne have said recently, we're not doing that anymore. We're just going to do story for kids, which surely is the way it should be. So I think it's really important. Just on the other story tonight, as I said earlier on when we were chatting at the bar, I think it's very nice to hear a story about a 1970s celebrity that's being demonised for doing good things. Because, let's face it, it hasn't been like that recently. I'm moving on.
There's going to be stories about Benny Hill in tomorrow morning's newspapers, aren't there? Oh, sorry, Benny. We didn't mean to do that to you. Okay, does anybody else have any questions for our two readers tonight? Pete?
For the purposes tonight, you can call me Justin. So, a question for Andy. The books are about finding an identity, and genetics are very key. So how did you sort of blend in science and genetics to that sort of story? And then a question to Ken afterwards, as I see that you're writing a story called Dying Inside, D-Y-E. So are puns in all of your stories?
The genesis for the stories was a short story competition that had a genetics theme. Effectively, the opening chapter of the book was the short story. Didn't get anywhere, wasn't accepted for the anthology, but I liked the idea of it. And it was, I mean, I know it's not a new road to tread, but it was he wasn't a superhero, he wasn't a mutant, he's just a normal boy. And all these things were happening to him, and he didn't know why. And to obviously just try and get away and then figure out what was happening. As far as the genetics, and some people think it's sci-fi as well. I mean, it's set only slightly in the near future. his origins have actually already happened. That was in 2012 when he was technically born. But I quite like playing with that. It was rather than lasers and ray guns and hoverboards, it was kind of trying to visualize not too far in the future what technology would be like. And you know, it's not going to be hoverboards and flying ships and things, and it's, I don't think it's too far dissimilar from where we are now. But it was fun. It was fun to play with that. Just having it, just, you know, look 20 years or, you know, 15 years in the future and see what it was going to be like. But it was good. It was interesting. You can let your imagination run a little bit, but not too far. There aren't many puns in my stories, unfortunately, but I think there will be. I think there'll be more aquatic mammals. I like the idea of that, particularly an alcoholic otter. I think that's fantastic. I'm going to, I think I might introduce some more.
Before answering your question, Justin, I'd also just like to chip in very quickly on the young adult the young adult equality in writing side of things. And just a quick obvious solution, I'd say that the books that for me have most managed just bridged that very well seem to take one very simplistic step, which is they treat both boys and girls, effectively, or characters that are boys and girls, straightforwardly as equals. If romantic things arise, which often seems to be the main issue of the boy-girl book, they're muted, they're very much understated, not a major part of the plot. And two series, one fairly recent, one further back, that I'd recommend as young adult novels for anyone would be Charlie Higson's The Enemy series, and way back in from the 70s, Michael Bellarabese's The Borrowbulls trilogy, which are quite similar in a lot of ways in their sort of urban setting and nasty, gritty survivalist feel. Moving on to puns, well, yeah, it's a regressible tendency, I'm going to find. It's something I must really try to curb. The thing is that a lot of my early reading in fantasy literature of all sorts did come from people like Frederick Brown, and people like Robert Bloch, and you can't walk two steps in one of their short stories without tripping over a pun, whether it's in the title, the main body of the text. No matter how horrific the stories sometimes get, it's always there, usually. And just to rattle up a quick series of titles, the first story I've had professionally published, Case of the Vapors, that's a pun, albeit a slightly more obscure one than some. You've got Hillraiser, there's a short story I've got here, it has also been sold called There's No called No Race Like Gnomes, which has been sold on due for publication sometime this year. Dying Inside is a pun as well, yes, definitely. But I have tried to watch that, and my titles are at least starting to get a bit more varied. Now they're going to the areas of quotes. The latest thing I've written has a quote from Sullivan, Bedknobs and Broomsticks as its title, rather than a pun, for example. No mermaids, but there are sea creatures, oddly enough. And I've also written just a rhetorical question for the title of the latest one, which is Whose Graveyard, which gives a clue to the outcome, but again isn't a pun of any sort. So puns are fun in moderation in the right place. It's that classic thing, but if you're trying to tell too serious a story, try and keep them in check. And that's really the best advice I can give.
If we discover that you're not keeping them in check, we will sit you down and make you read Piers Anthony's Ant novels. until you feel that you've been punished enough. At which point our problem will be solved. Are there any other questions for our two readers? Okay, so Andy, we've heard the first chapter or so of your books. It sounds like there's a fair amount more. How many books have you got out and what's coming?
There's two of the Tiberius books out at the moment. It comes under the umbrella title of The Emperor Initiative. You quickly find out in the stories that the series of tests that the scientists have started start out with Caesar and Tiberius, etc., etc. And you find out that the experiments are carried on in young Daniel's absence. So they're not running out of emperors. There are other ones that are down the chain. So there are three in the series. I've gone for alliterative titles. So there's Tiberius Found. The second book is Tiberius Bound. And the third book is Tiberius Crowned. Which I think was quite nice. It was alliterative. It seems to roll off the tongue quite well. But they fall initially. It was only ever going to be one book. But with young adult, as with any genre, there's a word limit that's acceptable. And as I was sort of honing it down, I was coming up close to the word limit count. I thought if I'm going to wrap it all up in the one book, it's just going to be not quite, he woke up and it was all a dream, but it just wouldn't work. So at that point I thought, okay, there's enough legs for a second story. And as I started to block that one out, I thought, actually, no, again, it's not going to be wrapped up. So it warranted a third one. And that actually fall very neatly into sections of his discovery, how people are reacting with him, and the information he's finding out. As a pure timeline, I don't know if you've read any of the Anthony Horowitz, Alex Rider novels, but they effectively all take part pretty much over a summer, all of them. So they're all very quick succession from one to the other. But the Tiberius stories effectively, again, take part within about 3 or 4 months of each other from start to finish. The third one is in the editing stage at the moment, but that should be out by the end of the year. So that wraps that series up. However, the final book, I wouldn't say the door is open, but it's certainly unlocked in case of any more that I feel fancy not doing. So it leaves it open for scope for more. So that's those three. But the next one that's coming out is, again, young adult, but it's a period one set in 1926. And it's a supernatural kind of murder mystery adventure. Sound familiar? Myself and Pete, we used to be involved in a group that ran supernatural murder mysteries, actual live roleplay events. And it's very heavily influenced by that. And that story, again, features a young lad as the main character, and it features the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And that's finished the editing stage now. I'm just getting the artwork polished, so that should be out in the next month or two.
I suppose from a technical point of view, if you're writing books about school children, you really need to like cram a thing into school holidays. I think I remember from you know, centuries ago when I was a kid reading Enid Blyton, that the kids always went off and had an adventure on their summer holidays. And by the time you'd read 20 of them that were adventures that the same kids had on their summer holidays, you started to wonder how old they got. But yeah, that is a constraint, yeah?
It certainly can be. Obviously, the Tiberius stories don't tie into that because he's fleeing the country, effectively, so that doesn't tie into the holidays. The 1920s one, the period one, that first book falls in, funnily enough, in the Easter break. Subsequent stories will fall into, again, yeah, school holiday periods.
Ken, you mentioned that your gnome story had been accepted for publication. Where can we find that?
Well, at the moment, it's due for publication. The latest date is sometime this year, so it should be before the end of this year, but I can't tell exactly when. It's been accepted for an anthology called Tales of the Damned, being put together by Richard Freeman, a Fortean horror anthology. And that was largely where the whole gnomes thing in the story as written came from. There is a Fortean tale told, however much no little troopy cared to ascribe to it, during the 60s, a rash of sightings in various parks in Liverpool, I believe it was, of gnomes racing tiny little racing cars around park grounds. And at one point, apparently, a gnome aeroplane was even spotted. There were several accounts of these from children, and obviously a lot of adults dismissed these as pure fantasising, but then the children were asked questions in school individually, so they couldn't form the story between them in this time. They all gave consistent accounts, and people started wondering, maybe is there something, and maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but it was just something that caught the imagination, and that's why it got written, really.
Possibly the gnomes were reenacting wacky races. That would be seriously cool. Okay, anybody have any ideas for questions while we've been chatting away? No, in that case, I think it's time for plugging things that are going to be happening in Bristol over the coming months. Claire?
Hello. The next Fringe meeting will be on the 18th of August. I know that some of you won't be able to make it, because there's lots of conventions. But it's going to be the one-year anniversary of Fringe. 1 year! Thank you. We should all be very proud of ourselves. And we're going to be doing an open mic night. So everyone turns up and you get 5 minutes to read anything, short story, poem, or part of a chapter. The buzzer will go off, you stop reading, the next person jumps up. That's the basic idea. So it's going to be so much fun. And that's all I've got.
Yes, well, sadly, I won't be there because I'll be at this little thing in London, the World Science Fiction Convention or whatever it is it's called. But I hope you all have good fun without me. However, I will be back on the 25th because there is a fabulous event happening there up in Clifton. Pete?
Yeah, on the 25th, we've got both Anne van der Meer and Jeff van der Meer appearing as part of the Small Stories... Well, Small Stories Big Books is what we're calling it. So the guys that run Small Stories, which is a monthly reading event, are going to put this on in association with Bristol Festival of Literature, Bristol Con, and Wizards Tower Press. Anne and Jeff Anime are coming over from the States. They don't often come to the UK. Anne's an award-winning editor for Tor.com, Weird Magazine, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And Jeff's an award-winning author of City and States of Mad Men, the Ambergreen novels, Annihilation, Acceptance, Southern Reach novels, etc., etc. So that's quite exciting. The small stories for August, I'll be reading at a story that involves the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, in fact. And before that, Southfield Writers are doing a flash fiction open mic on the 29th of July. So come along with a 1,000-word story and do open mic there.
And just to give a further plug for the van der Meer event, Anne won a Hugo for editing Weird Tales. As Pete mentioned, she is currently an editor at Tor.com, which I believe is the best-paying fiction market for science fiction fantasy at the moment. So if you are interested in selling short fiction of that type, get along there and introduce yourself. There are a few spaces left. Yeah, it's going to be at the Lansdowne up in Clifton, which is apparently a very nice place. Kevin Henney used it for the Shorty Stay flash fiction event. And we reckon we can fit in about 50 people, and currently we have 38 places taken. It is free to attend, but get on with it. And there's something up on my blog about it. There's something up on Pete's blog about it. And I'll try and stick something up on the BristolCon blog when I get an opportunity to do so. Apparently somebody called Cheryl Morgan is going to be doing the interviewing, but don't let that put you off attending. She has occasionally been known to ask people questions, and Anne and Jeff haven't been told to run away. Does anybody else have an event or publication or anything that they would like to plug? Well, in which case, hope to see you at some of these events coming up in August, or indeed some of this rash of conventions coming up in August. And fingers crossed we will sell a few airships and things along the way. Thank you, everybody.